this is the Angry GM, and it is time for another proofread aloud, but this proofread aloud has a twist, or rather an untwist. For the first time in a long while, I'm recording a proofread aloud without doing it on the live chat channel in my Discord server, so there is no one listening live, and consequently, there will be no question and answer supplemental podcast thingy to follow this. That's for a number of reasons. First of all, I'm doing an Ask Angry Mailbag today, and it seems a little inception-y to have a question and answer session to what is essentially a long 3,000-word question and answer article. But the other reason is just that I am really, 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 really strapped for time and more than a little strapped for mental energy as well. So I just have to get this done as quickly as possible so that I can get it out on time and move on to the next of the 10,000 things that I am trying to do this week. So all of that said, let's launch into the proofread aloud of Ask Angry February 2023 Mailbag, which is the title. And what a delightful title that is. That paints just a beautiful word picture. Ask Angry February 2023 Mailbag. Every once in a while, usually when I'm out of ideas and need to crap out some quick content, I open up my big ol' mailbag and answer some reader questions. If you want your question considered for use in a future Ask Angry column, send it to ask.angry@angry.games. Keep it short and simple, tell me what to call you, and give me explicit permission to call you that. And don't send anything urgent. I won't get to do another one of these until April at the earliest. Queen asks, in your article about your GMing credo, your first rule was, I am a dungeon master and nothing else. You correctly noted this meant nothing to us and said you could write a full article about it. Could you? Pretty please? No, I ain't gonna write that article. It'd be overwrought crap. But I will explain myself. At least, I'll explain what I meant when I said what I said. Partly, it's a genre and setting thing. I love fantasy adventure. Romantic, anachro-medieval, European fantasy adventure. There's a lot to love about it. A lot of the values romanticized in the genre made me the man I am today. I forgot, made me the man. I wrote, made me the maid. Which is very, very different. Okay. There's a lot to love about it. A lot of the values romanticized in the genre made me the man I am today, or at least the model I strive to live up to. As Jason J. Derris once said, I didn't spend all those years playing Dungeons & Dragons without learning a thing or two about courage. But mostly, it's about how I see tabletop role-playing games and what tabletop role-playing games are about. Tabletop role-playing games aren't collaborative storytelling experiences. The GM isn't there to provide a stage or backdrop or sandbox or toy box. The GM is a game designer. The GM can design games full of detailed characters and brimming with dramatic emotions, but the GM's still designing games. The dungeon symbolizes that tenet because a dungeon is just about the gamiest thing you can get in Dungeons & Dragons. Tabletop role-playing games are about characters undertaking quests. They're about heroes leaving the safety of the civilized world to conquer a dangerous, chaotic world full of monsters, to face challenges only they can face and come back richer and better for the experience. All else, factional infighting, court intrigues, YA romantic bullshit, that's all secondary background crap, if it exists at all. People are going to read too much into this and lose their damned minds. People are going to read too much into this and lose their damn minds. They'll think I'm saying tabletop role-playing games are ipsy-facty dungeon crawls and nothing else counts as real role-playing gaming. But People are stupid. My games aren't just endless strings of dungeon crawls. The PCs live rich lives in detailed worlds. But those lives involve leaving civilization, plunging into the underworld with purpose, and coming back transformed. Over and over. Side note. I wrote that crap 8 years ago. In rereading, I was surprised to see how much of it I still believe, given I've gone through some drastic changes of late, and how much it still informs the true game mastery series I've just started. In fact, there are only two, and precisely two, personal beliefs on that list I no longer believe. See if you can guess which ones I'd dump if I were writing that list today. Post a comment with your guess. Someone who doesn't get what "give me explicit permission to use your name" means asks, a while back you explained how you deliver information about monsters to your players using gargoyles as an example. Do you ever gate monster information behind knowledge checks? And do you ever give more information based on higher check results? Are you talking about the sample narration I provided in How I Roll the Angry Manual of Style? That wasn't about die rolls, but rather about weaving exposition into the narration. Because your players should never have to ask what their characters know or use bullshit non-actions. I try to recall what I know about the creatures, and your game shouldn't grind to a halt as your players struggle to figure out how to share the information they have, and no one should utter the idiotic word metagaming. How you decide what exactly the characters know? That's up to you. Me? I use knowledge skill checks all the time, especially when I'm running Dungeons & Dragons version 3.5, also known as D&D Best. And I do provide more information for better results. I know the DC necessary to identify the creature and recall basic information about it. If the player's check exceeds that DC by 5 or 10, I provide more detailed, more useful information. And before you ask, no, I don't prepare tables in advance. I just wing this crap. I'm a game master, not a video game. My point was, I don't wait for the players to ask for such checks. The moment a character's background knowledge might give the players an edge, I ask for a roll. Or, more often, roll it myself behind the screen. And I don't describe or narrate jack squat until I know what the characters know about whatever's happening. That way my narration includes the information the characters know. Fortunately, I've got a true game mastery lesson on exactly this in the chamber and ready to shoot off in your face. That didn't sound right. BC asks, way back, in your articles about Flight to El Terrell, you said you always name your adventures and campaigns. Do you tell your players the name? What's the benefit of doing so? Yes, I do name my campaigns and adventures. I name everything I write or design. A thing must have a name before I work on it. I don't know if there's any benefit to it. I suspect there is. But I know I can't work on a thing that doesn't have a name. That's just how I am. Also, I'm really bad at saving files and keeping files organized. So naming a thing and numbering it and putting it in the right place forces me to save stuff in a way that enables me to find it again. I give my players the names of the campaigns they're playing in, but I usually don't share adventure names. I don't purposely hide them, they just don't come up. Sometimes I'll say something like, next week is the final session of the Forsaken Flotilla. I'm looking forward to killing you all. But that's just idle conversation. I don't know if there's any benefit to sharing the names or not sharing them, but again, I suspect there is a benefit to sharing a campaign name, and I suspect it's to do with building excitement and engagement and selling pitches. As a side note, people do lots of things without being able to explain the benefits, and most of the time the benefits they think they're getting are made up. Nearly everything every human brain does, something like 90% of all choices, are automatic habits that the brain rationalizes after the fact. The brain's complicated, especially the creative intuitive parts, and it's good at recognizing when things work, even if the conscious brain sucks at explaining it. Another nameless questioner who can't follow simple instructions asks, when using a campaign setting book, what information from it do you need to start a campaign? Do you have to memorize the entire book? Holy mother-loving crap, no. If memorizing setting books were necessary, no human GM would ever run a campaign in a published setting. No one memorizes 300-page textbooks full of useless, boring-ass expositional fluff. Because that's what's in there. Boring-ass expositional fluff. First, the minute you start running a game in Galarian, or whatever, the setting ceases to be Paizo's Galarian and becomes Nameless Questioner Who Can't Follow Simple Instructions Galarian. The setting's yours. You don't have to get it right. You can do anything you want to it. And being true to the setting is a dumb, impossible goal because it's you, the GM running the game, that determines whether the game's any good. The setting has almost nothing to do with it. That said, read the setting book once through. Mostly. At the very least, skim the whole book and read the interesting parts. Don't try to memorize anything. Don't take detailed notes. Just let your creative brain soak the setting in. It will, even if you don't know what's happening. As you're reading or skimming, do take mental note of anything to which you say, man, I want to use that, or I want my game to feature that location, or whatever. Put little sticky note flags in the book. When you're done, you'll have a short list of the setting's most interesting elements, locales, characters, factions, and other random crap. Ultimately, you want to identify a way to start your game, a town or kingdom and an idea for a first adventure. This ain't any different from starting a homebrew campaign. The whole wide campaign world doesn't matter. All that matters is where the PCs start and what they're doing in session one. Reread the stuff you flagged carefully, and this time, take some notes. Note specific elements, characters, and points of interest around which to build your first adventure. And then, build the first adventure and run the hell out of it. Peter asks, your latest article made me think, how much is actually assumed that the Game Master is capable of that is washed in most instructionals? The mechanics enable the PCs to be developed or played, but the GM should be the one to make the actual decisions. Tabletop role-playing games are like this. Players get to decide what their characters do given the situation the GM describes. And that's all they get to decide. The GM decides how those actions play out and what happens next. The GM decides what situations come up. And the GM decides what characters the players are allowed to build. The GM is the master of the game. The rules are tools. The GM can and should use those tools to determine how the game plays out, but the GM can ignore them or change them or eliminate them. If the GM wants to take the dice out of the game and decide for himself how every single action works out, he can. And if he thinks that's the best way to run a game, he should do just that. There are good reasons to use the rules as written whenever possible, mind you. But no GM is required to do so. I think role-playing game books make a giant-ass mistake in even speaking to players, let alone inviting them to play with the game's rules instead of playing with the world the GM presents. The players can and should understand how most actions get resolved and what their stats mean. They can't make good strategic decisions otherwise. But modern games have too many player-facing rules, and they let the players tinker with too many rules. For example, the player should never, ever be allowed to decide anything based purely on a die roll. You may decide to apply this bonus after the die is rolled is bullshit. Modern game instructions are afraid to tell players that GMs are in charge and that's how it's supposed to be, and how it works best. And that leads to spoiled, entitled, spoiled, entitled, selfish, bratty players GMs don't want to run games for. There's no need to protect players from bad GMs, nor any need to protect GMs from bad players, because there has always been a simple failsafe that protects everyone from a crappy experience. It's that no human being can be forced to play a game they don't want to play, and no human being can be forced to play with someone they don't want to play with. If I don't want you at my table, you don't get to play my game. If you don't want to play my game, I can't make you play. That means if GMs and players want to play together, they've got to negotiate the terms under which they'll play. But it also means players and GMs alike can always say, "That's a deal breaker, I'm out." And that's something kids used to learn in preschool. Jerry asks, "While you have been quite liberal with your opinions about the various iterations of D&D," oh my, wow, as I read that out loud, that's a, "while you have been quite liberal with your opinions about the various iterations of D&D," are we writing like the Federalist Papers of tabletop role-playing games here? Is this actually like, you know, Jerry Adams, the long descendant of John Adams? Anyway. "While you have been quite liberal with your opinions about the various iterations of D&D, as well as a few other D&D-adjacent TTRPGs," yes, "I don't recall any comments on your part about the old-school revival TTRPGs. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts." Thank you, Jerry, for that question. And may God's fortune ever smile upon you and your family and your kith and kin. All right. Enough clear, concise answers. It's time, by the way, none of that was written into the article. It was just, as I read that out loud, it's like, well, while you have been quite liberal. Yes. So anyway, so that is a treat only the listeners get to hear. Anyway. "I'd be curious to hear your thoughts," ends Jerry. All right, enough clear, concise answers. It's time for a rambling, unfocused speech. Hold on to your butts. First, I have zero valid opinions about old-school revival tabletop role-playing games. I don't form opinions of game systems until I've played or run them for a minimum of 3 sessions. And I don't form good opinions until my 10th or 12th session. And I should just stop typing here. But I won't. I have read through several OSR rule books, mostly stuff that does more than just file the serial numbers off the oldest editions of D&D. And that's because I'm a connoisseur of game mechanics and I'm always looking for new ideas. And I have been looking for a new fantasy adventure tabletop role-playing game to try out. So I've read stuff like Dungeon Crawl Classics, Basic Fantasy Role-Playing Game, Adventurer Conqueror King, Worlds Without Number, Lamentations of the Flame Princess, Five Torches Deep, and most recently, Castles and Crusades. And I am starting up a CNC... I missed some words there, and also there I need to break that sentence. And now the italics got stuck in the on position. Italics off. And I am starting up a Castles and Crusades campaign soon, as it happens, so I'll have more to say about that in the future. I'm not purposely avoiding OSR games, mind you, or non-D&D games. Really, the biggest problem is my lack of time. Since this crap became my day job, I've ironically got way less time to play games. And also, I have to spend more free time not gaming because all gaming feels a little bit like work these days. With my gaming time thus limited, I end up back behind the D&D screen a lot because, despite my complaints about various editions, D&D is the only game that's like D&D. And even at its worst, I still like D&D. Modern D&D. Thing is, I started with D&D back in the late 80s. So BESME and AD&D 2E were my games. And I know the OSR community considers those iterations to be the places where it all went wrong. Point is, I don't have much romantic nostalgia for proper OSR fare. And without that, I'm simply left considering OSR games on their merits as TTRPGs. And most OSR games just don't grab me on their merits. I believe, in the core of my GMing being, in the art of game design, and in the GM as game designer. And that includes both mechanical design and scenario design. A well-designed game is a beautiful thing that brings together all the best that gameplay and narrative experiences have to offer. Lots of OSR games reject the trappings of modern game design. They lean heavily on the idea that the GM is the only mechanic a tabletop role-playing game needs, and many of them reject design elegance and intuitive mechanical tool sets. And that, by the way, is what keeps me from going back to BESME or AD&D 2E, despite my nostalgia. By the way, BESME is B-E-C-M-I. That is the abbreviation for the basic Dungeons & Dragons, as opposed to Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. In the 80s, there was a product line called Dungeons & Dragons, which started with the basic set and then went through the expert set, companion set, master set, and immortal set, or B-E-C-M-I, just to clarify for those listening, because I don't actually know how to say this, and it's more than the Mensa Red Box. I mentioned the Mensa Red Box a lot, but I played, you know, B-E-C-M-I, and that's clumsy to say. So it's BESME, or BECME, but I like BESME better. So short C it is. Anyway, many OSR games reject design elegance and intuitive mechanical tool sets. And that, by the way, is what keeps me from going back to BESME or AD&D 2E, despite my nostalgia. Those games got a lot right, and Mensur was a genius about presenting information and converting newbies into game designer GMs. But they're janky, kludgy, mechanical messes. And that's only because the principles of tabletop game design were still evolving. And they still are. Many OSR games also reject the idea of GM as designer of curated gameplay and narrative experiences. And the OSR movement has become steeped in the idea that there's a certain proper kind of OSR. It's one in which the GM builds a sandbox and presents it as is for the players to explore. I'm not saying there's no place in tabletop role-playing games for that kind of game. Of course there is. But I reject the notion that that's the ideal rather than a highly specialized kind of game that appeals to a specialized group of players. Worlds Without Number, for example, and I really need to include for example. Okay. Worlds Without Number, for example, drove me away with its introduction. The book started with a long speech about how Worlds Without Number was meant for sandbox play, and while I could use it for other things, I shouldn't, and I was wrong, but I could be forgiven. So back onto the shelf went Worlds Without Number. I think that attitude sells really short what a true game master is capable of. It's very similar to the modern D&D attitude that the GM is there to build a stage on which the players get to show off their original, amazing fanfic characters and play out their personal dramas without the GM's interference. The point is, I have yet to find the OSR TTRPG that gives me what I want. I want modern mechanics, well-designed, intuitive, and elegant. And I want meat. I like tactical combat play. Most players do. And within reason, I want proper game design, I want proper game balance tools that let GMs create rewarding challenge progressions without needing a PhD in game and scenario design. I want a game that enables, nay, empowers, a GM to design good scenarios, ones that allow the players the agency they want and deserve from a tabletop role-playing game, without sacrificing the tenets of gameplay progression, pacing, narrative design, and all the other crap that makes for good games and good stories. Right now, D&D, post-2000 D&D, or Pathfinder, is still the closest I can get to any of that crap in a solidly designed package. And I think that's one of the reasons why D&D and Pathfinder sell so well. They actually do come closest to providing They actually do come closest to providing most GMs and most players a good experience. That's why my for fun game of choice remains D&D version 3.5, and why Castles and Crusades is the OSR game that did manage to turn my pretty little head. Because it strikes me as AD&D 2.5th edition, and I only checked it out because I've come to deeply respect Troll Lord Games' stance regarding the place of designers and publishers in the gaming community and its approach to the OGL crap show. In the end, though, I probably won't be truly happy until I build my own damn game. And that is the proofread aloud. We are done, and I will be back next week with another one, and that one, I promise, will maybe, probably, possibly be live. Until then, hasta lasagna.